Please welcome bienvenidos.
Hola, aloha.
Ni hao, namaste. Konnichiwa, bonjour, buongiorno.
Sawadee karup,
guten tag.
Ciao, wee viva, cat bang.
Half a day,
jai janendra.
Salam, shalom, peace.
Now,
go vegan.
Peace, how? Go vegan.
From the left coast of the unlabeled, genetically mutated McNugget pharmaceutical vivisection prison kilitary industrial corporation in the cheese-covered post-constitutional bankster bankrupt corruptocracy mocracy criminocracy of the United States of Listeria, foodborne in the NSA, NRA, USA, home of Uncle Sam Manila, where they sure do eat a lot of dead animal body parts, and the Wall Street-backed corporate diet of death, disease, and destruction is shoved down your throat. This is Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. The Sunday before yet another massive massacre in the annual ritualistic tradition of a cult of endless bizarre animal sacrifice. Yes, I'm talking about Bloody Thanksgiving. Oh, I could have been talking about any breakfast, lunch, or dinner for that matter, but on Thanksgiving, the primitives demand the sacrifice of almost 50 million innocent birds. To give thanks, these barbarians take lives. To give thanks, they take lives. And please forgive me for referring to, you know, the barbarians as barbarians. I apologize. One sees things a little differently, more clearly. I didn't say that. No, I said that one sees things a bit differently, more clearly, after being vegan for 30 years. I don't know if Chris Hedges will see things my way. He just went vegan a couple of weeks ago. So I don't know if he'll quite have the same vegan filter that I do. But as far as I see it, being vegan for 30 years, I mean, I know you think that you're all modern and all, but I basically see cavemen in loincloths with iPhones gathered around the tribal pit, grunting and ripping flesh from a corpse. So modern, with their big flat-screen TVs now, right? Munching that fossil food, watching cavemen in loincloths and, throwing and kicking the skin that's been picked from a corpse, also picked from a corpse, right? So that's the entertainment, that's the food. When was the last time that I was at a dead bird celebration? I really can't remember. I never really was forced into that uncomfortable family situation that many vegans will face on Thursday. Yes, it is hard being the most evolved member of your clan, and I don't know, maybe you can, downplay it a little bit with, maybe a few more tattoos. I don't know. Yet, all the members of your tribe, just about everyone, loves animals, right? So, if on Thursday, on the way to Granny's house, on the way to, who would be the nicest, most normal granny, huh? Who would that be? Like Ozzie and Harriet, right? Like June Cleaver, okay? Yes, kids, we're driving to Granny Cleaver's house for Thanksgiving. And if on that ride to Granny Cleaver, a truck full of live turkeys overturned on the highway, everybody would be running to help the turkeys, to save them, to help them avoid being hurt. People would cry if any of the birds were hurt. And then they would get back in the car and drive to Granny Cleaver's for turkey dinner. Oh, and laugh and be happy and have a good old time with a murder victim as the centerpiece of their
joyful celebration. How can this be? Why aren't they crying for the birds now? I mean, look at the family gathering. Everybody, it should be mourning. Everybody should be crying. But for some reason, we can get past our guilt trip, right? You know, knowing that, the president will pardon one of the 50 million harmless innocents. And we can shed our collective guilt with the pardoning of one, or we can go vegan and pardon them all, right? And why are the innocent birds? They're harmless. Why are they getting a pardon? As if they committed a crime? Huh? Oh yeah, they committed the crime of being born, born directly into death row, born directly into Guantanamo, right? Some of them, yeah, force-fed, just like Guantanamo. They committed the crime of being born into a world of a cult of murder eaters. Is it Halloween every day, every meal? Yes. Murder eaters thankful for the opportunity, to suck their blood. No one was quite that honest with me when I was a child at the family Thanksgiving, when my father had the cleaver in his hand and he carved the rotting cadaver. It was, here, Bobby, have a drumstick. Okay, I'll have a drumstick. Sure, why not? Oh, and don't spill any gravy on your loincloth, Bobby. Okay, I won't. Okay, drumstick, huh? Now we're not, of course, ripping the flesh from the bones off someone's body. We're playing musical instruments, huh? It's kind of amazing, huh? Well, Bobby, it's actually leg of bird. You love animals, right, Bobby? Like you love the sparrows who eat the corn cobs on the fire escape, right? Well, instead of that, Bobby, these birds hang by their legs and upside down, and then they're stabbed. The throat is slashed, and then they're sliced into pieces, and then. Drumstick. Okay, all right. Hey, cannibals, huh? Learn your lesson, like that New York City police officer who had a craving for women flesh. Cannibals, here's a great PR campaign to make your eating disorder more acceptable. Name your cuts of meat musical instruments. Why not, huh? Let's see. Okay, remember, drumstick is already taken. So maybe when you, want Uncle Idi Amin to pass the human leg across the table there, you might just say, ask him to, please, pass the guitar, Uncle Idi, okay? And of course, if you can't identify the cut of human meat, just call it an organ. I don't know. Thanksgiving has gotten to be a little like Columbus Day, right? As in, what are we celebrating? Huh? It's a massacre to celebrate a massacre. The massacre of indigenous people. But first let them teach us how to grow corn, right? And then let's see how long it takes us to screw that up, too. Pilgrims, evolving into manifest destiny, meat, Monsanto, missiles. Yeah. So I don't know. It's sometimes you wonder should the indigenous peoples have let the pilgrims starve that winter? I don't think so. I think they had more of a generous attitude about it all. Some years back on the program, I had Dr. Rita Laws, she. Was carried in the International Vegetarian Union, and Dr. Rita Laws, the article was Native Americans and Vegetarianism. Of course, long ago, vegetarian could have meant vegan, until, of course, the meat and dairy industries, the dairy and poultry industries got a hold of it. Dr. Rita Laws wrote, How well we know the stereotype of the rugged plains Indian, killer of buffalo, dressed in quill-decorated buckskin, elaborately feathered headdress, and leather moccasins, living in an animal skin teepee, master of the dog and horse, and stranger to vegetables. But this lifestyle, once limited almost exclusively to the Apaches, flourished no more than a couple hundred years. It is not representative of most Native Americans of today or yesterday. Indeed, the buffalo as lifestyle phenomenon is a direct result of European influence, as we shall see. Dr. Law is saying here, among my own people, the Choctaw Indians of Mississippi and Oklahoma, vegetables are the traditional diet mainstay. A French manuscript of the 18th century describes the Choctaw's vegetarian leanings in shelter and food. The homes were constructed not of skins, but of wood, mud, bark, and cane. The principal food eaten daily from earthen pots was a vegetarian stew containing corn, pumpkin, and beans. The bread was made from corn and acorns. Other common favorites were roasted corn and corn porridge. Let's see what else. The ancient Choctaws were first and foremost farmers. Even the clothing was plant-based. Artistically embroidered dresses for the women and cotton breeches for the men. Choctaws have never adorned their hair with feathers. You know, thinking about that with feathers, you know, again, coming up the day after Thursday this week, Friday, is Fur Free Friday. When will that evolve? When will we include leather, right? And wool, silk, and feathers. Don't wear animals at all. Don't wear their skins. Don't wear feathers. Coming up on today's program, Professor Michael Dorff, who will be a speaker at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. We'll talk about the lessons we can learn from other social justice movements. Professor Gary Francione coming up, too. We continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, and Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, also a couple of Bob Linden pages on Facebook. And coming up later in the program, Professor Michael Dorff of Cornell University, and he will be one of the speakers at the World Vegan Summit and Expo coming up in March at the Marina Del Rey Marriott in Southern California. The website is worldvegansummit.com. And perhaps you would like to win a free ticket, the green ticket, the all-access wonderful green ticket that gets you everywhere, along with the expo, of course, all the speakers' presentations, the Friday night reception, breakfast, lunch, and dinner on Saturday, breakfast and lunch on Sunday, snacks. It's the one. It's the all-inclusive. So what we're doing is, if you'd like to give it a shot and try to win a free green ticket, what you do is email goveganradio@gmail.com. goveganradio@gmail.com. In the subject area, put win, W-I-N, and in the text area, your name and phone number. Okay, you have until noon on Sunday, December 7th, to do that. And then on that evening's program, go to goveganradio.com, click Listen Live, listen for your name between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Pacific time. If you hear your name, you'll have 10 minutes to call. The number that you would call at that time is 855-660-4261. That's 855-660-4261. Of course, I'll be telling you that the day when you're listening for your name, which is the program on December 7th. And again, you'll click Listen Live at GoVeganRadio.com. And what you'll do then is actually be listening live. So then if we don't hear from the person within 10 minutes, we'll go on to the next name. We'll just keep doing that until we give away the valuable green ticket to the World Vegan Summit and Expo, which is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. You'll definitely want to be there. In fact, if you don't want to leave it to chance, you can go to worldvegansummit.com and click register and register right now and check it out. The activities, the speakers, the subject matter, really amazing. And we're basically gathering because we know we need to jumpstart a vegan movement. You know, I mean, the animal rights movement has become quite bizarre in what it endorses. In particular, the furnished cages, which have now become what's known as humane. So anyway. Oh, and by the way, for Thanksgiving, of course you don't want to eat a dead bird, but Vegetarian House in San Jose is preparing just a most wonderful Thanksgiving, and I suggest that you you get in touch if you're anywhere in the San Francisco Bay Area. You make it your biz to get over there on Wednesday or Thursday. Vegetarian House at 520 East Santa Clara Street. The website is vegetarianhouse.us with a number of alternatives to eating a decomposing dead bird. And when you hear about the salmonella poisonings that go on continuously, turkey too, you know, it's not just chicken, you know, the ongoing Foster Farms debacle that, you know, continues to this day. They can never keep conditions clean enough in mass production of animals, or even in small production, right? And even on the so-called family farm, the ridiculous concept of humane meat being sold to us by the animal rights movement right now, supposedly the HSUSs and ASPCAs, all of them partners with the Mercy for Animals people, all. The strange axes of evil. I just saw, an ASPCA and HSUS ad for humane turkey for Thanksgiving when they should be asking everyone to go vegan. Anyway, register now, worldvegansummit.com. Continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, Twitter at GoVeganRadio, and Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden on Facebook. And again, you can register right now for the World Vegan Summit and Expo at WorldVeganSummit.com. Coming up next hour, two of the illustrious speakers at the event, Professor Michael Dorf coming up next hour, and Professor Gary Francione. A little bit earlier, I was talking about the article that first appeared in the Vegetarian Journal, September 1994, published by the Vegetarian Resource Group, written by Dr. Rita Laws. And very often the word vegetarian does mean vegan, as you see when we talked about the recipes here, that the vegetarian corn and beans and acorns and all. So anyway, the title of the article was Native Americans and Vegetarianism. And have we ever been under misconceptions? Of course, all the time, right? So I'm in quoting Dr. Laws. She said the ancient Choctaws were first and foremost farmers. Even the clothing was plant-based, which means vegan. Even the clothing was vegan. Artistically embroidered dresses for the women and cotton breeches for the men. Choctaws have never adorned their hair with feathers. She says the rich lands of the Choctaws in present-day Mississippi were so greatly coveted by 19th-century Americans that most of the tribe was forcibly removed to what is now called Oklahoma. Oklahoma was chosen both because it was largely uninhabited and because several explorations of the territory had deemed the land barren and useless for any purpose. The truth, however, was that Oklahoma was so fertile a land that it was an Indian breadbasket. That is, it was used by Indians on all sides as an agricultural resource. Although many Choctaws suffered and died during removal on the infamous Trail of Tears, those that survived built anew and successfully in Oklahoma, their agricultural genius intact. George Catlin, the famous 19th-century Indian historian, described the Choctaw lands of southern Oklahoma in the 1840s this way, quote, "The ground was almost literally covered with vines, producing the greatest profusion of delicious grapes and hanging in such endless clusters. Our progress was oftentimes completely arrested by hundreds of acres of small plum trees. Every bush that was in sight was so loaded with the weight of its fruit that they were in many instances literally without leaves on their branches and quite bent to the ground. And beds of wild currants, gooseberries, and edible prickly pear. Many of the wild foods Anglo explorers encountered on their journeys were actually carefully cultivated by Indians. Many of the Choctaw foods cooked at celebrations even today are vegetarian and sound vegan to me. Dr. Law says, corn is so important to us, it is considered divine. Our corn legend says that it was a gift from Hashtali, the Great Spirit. Corn was given in gratitude because Choctaws had fed the daughter of the Great Spirit when she was hungry. Hashtali is literally noonday sun. Choctaws believe the Great Spirit resides within the sun, for it is the sun that allows the corn to grow. Another Choctaw story describes the afterlife as a giant playground where all but murderers are allowed. What do Choctaws eat in heaven? Their sweetest treat, of course, melons, a never-ending supply. So that's heaven to the Choctaws, a never-ending supply of melons. That sounds so nice. Sounds so much better than a dead bird celebration. Also in the article, Dr. Law says, more than one tribe has creation legends which describe people as vegetarian. We may presume vegan in many cases here, I'm sure, living in a kind of Garden of Eden. A Cherokee legend describes humans, plants, and animals as having lived in the beginning in equality and mutual helpfulness. The needs of all were met without killing one another. When man became aggressive and ate some of the animals invented diseases to keep human population in check. The plants remained friendly, however, and offered themselves not only as food to man, but also as medicine to combat the new diseases. More tribes were like the Choctaws than were different. Aztec, Mayan, and Zapotec children, did I get that right? In olden times are 100% eight 100% vegetarian diets. So that would mean vegan, okay? So Dr. Laws is saying Aztec, Mayan, and Zapotec children in olden times ate 100% vegetarian diets. At least until the age of 10 years old, huh? Okay, well, they should have kept it going then, huh? The primary food was cereal, especially varieties of corn. Such a diet was believed to make the child strong and disease-resistant. The Spaniards were amazed to discover that these Indians had twice the lifespan they did. A totally vegetarian diet also ensured that the children would retain a long-life love of grains and thus live a healthier life. Even today, the Indian healers of those tribes are likely to advise the sick to return to the arms of Mother Corn in order to get well. Well, look out for Monsanto and GMO corn, though. Ugh, wouldn't you know what those pilgrims would bring us eventually, right? Let's see here. It says, such a return might include eating a lot of atole. The easiest way to make atole is to simmer commercially produced Mesa harina corn flour with water, then flavor it with chocolate or cinnamon and sweeten to taste. Atole is considered a sacred food. Chocolate and corn flour. Ah, I love it. Sacred food. Cinnamon. I'm with you. I'm there. Sounds like my Thanksgiving dinner right there. Dr. Law says, it is ironic that Indians are strongly associated with hunting and fishing when, in fact, nearly half of all the plant foods grown in the world today were first cultivated by the American Indians and were unknown elsewhere until the discovery of the Americas. Quote, discovery of the Americas. It looks like somebody may have been here before the discovery, huh? She says, can you imagine Italian food without tomato paste, Ireland without white potatoes, or Hungarian goulash without paprika? All these foods have Indian origins. An incomplete list of other Indian foods given to the world includes bell peppers, red peppers, peanuts, cashews, sweet potatoes, avocados, passion fruit, zucchini, green beans, kidney beans, maple syrup, lima beans, cranberries, pecans, okra, chocolate, vanilla, sunflower seeds, pumpkin, cassava, walnuts, 47 varieties of berries, pineapple, and of course, corn and popcorn. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. I would have nothing to eat if dependent upon, you know, if dependent upon what has evolved from the pilgrims, you know, McDevil's, Murder King, Wendy's, Kills Jr., Up Chuck E. Cheese. You know, I mean, thank you, native population, for actually giving the world food. Where was I in this? Dr. Laura says, many history textbooks tell the story of Squanto, a Pawtuxet Indian who lived in the early 1600s. Squanto was famous for having saved the pilgrims from starvation. He showed them how to gather wilderness foods and how to plant corn. There have been thousands of Squantos since, even though their names are not so well known. In fact, modern-day agriculture owes its heart and soul to Indian-taught methods of seed development, hybridization, planting, growing, irrigating, storing, utilizing, and cooking. But they never developed GMOs, huh? How about that? That took, you know, Pilgrim's Manifest Destiny, Monsanto. And the spirit of Squanto survives to this day. One example is a Peruvian government research station tucked away in a remote Amazon Indian village called Genaro Herrera. And this is Genaro Herrera University-trained botanists, agronomists, and foresters worked there, scientifically studying all the ways the local Indians grow and prepare food. They are also learning how to utilize forests without destroying them and how to combat so-called pests without chemicals. Sorry there. The trend that moved some North American Indian tribes away from plant food-based diets or vegan-based diets can be traced to Coronado, a 16th century Spanish explorer. Prior to his time, hunting was a hobby among most Indians, not a vocation. The Apaches were one of the few tribes who relied heavily on animal killing for survival. But all that changed as Coronado and his many and his army traversed the West and Midwest from Mexico. Some of his horses got away and quickly multiplied on the grassy plains. Indians retamed this new denizen, and the age of buffalo began. Horses replaced dogs as beasts of burden and offered excellent transportation. This was as important an innovation to the Plains Indians as the automobile would be to Anglos later on. Life on the plains became much easier very quickly, but apparently not easier on the buffalo. From the east came another powerful influence, guns. Okay, we'll talk about the influence of guns after the break. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. You can support the program with a tax-deductible donation. Click donate at goveganradio.com. Radio with Bob Linden at goveganradio.com, on Twitter at goveganradio and goveganradio with Bob Linden on Facebook, and you can register now for the World Vegan Summit and Expo. Go to worldvegansummit.com. Yes, we are giving away a free green ticket, and you get to the website and my Twitter and my Facebook, and the information is all there. Also, if you go to worldvegansummit.com, check out the sample menu. We will have, the green ticket is meal inclusive. It's an amazing menu. What can I say? An amazing international vegan menu. A lot of the food veganic, which is a step above organic even. A lot of veganic food there. And when we wake up in the morning, we will be drinking organic fair trade select coffee and select tea, S-E-E-L-E-C-T, from Nature's Flavors. You can go to naturesflavors.com. That might be a very helpful website for your holiday cooking. Nature's Flavors, a completely vegan company, if your family, somebody is, I want gluten-free, okay, so I want sugar-free. I want, it has to be vegan. Well, you can have a gluten-free, sugar-free, vegan brownie with the baking mix from Select. So, and also Bertie and Bill's sodas, and just a lot that can help you in the kitchen. A lot of the products available at Viva La Vegan Grocery. Go to VivaLaVeganGrocery.com. Viva La Vegan in Santa Monica and Rancho Cucamonga. Everybody, all of them, will be at the World Vegan Summit and Expo, as will be Our guest next hour, Michael Dorf, a professor of law at Cornell University. Also next hour, animal rights commentary with Professor Gary Francione. I was talking before the break about this article from Professor Rita Laws, who was talking about, you know, I mean, really the image we have and the history we have of the indigenous peoples here are really way off. So she was saying, from the East came another powerful influence, guns. The first American settlers brought their firearms with them because of the Indian so-called threat. They were soon immersed in weapons development and succeeded in making more accurate and powerful weapons. But they also supplied weapons to Indians who allied themselves with colonial causes. Because it was so much easier to kill an animal with a rifle than with a bow and arrow, guns spread quickly among the Indians, between the horse now, you know, brought by Coronado, as we mentioned before the break, and the rifle, well, then buffalo killing. Was now much simpler and became rampant among many of the indigenous people, who then seemed to abandon agriculture. Then it was, problems were obviously to come in the future. Dr. Laws says, had the Indians understood the concept of animal extinction, they may have ceased the slaughter. But to the Indians, the buffalo was a gift from the Great Spirit, a gift which would always keep coming, huh? Right? Decades after the disappearance of huge herds, Plains Indians still believe their return was imminent. They danced the ghost dance designed to bring back the buffalo and prayed for this miracle as late as 1890. As you know, not to happen. Just as, you know, we consume animal products now, is the climate to happen. Dr. Law said, I think she was saying, let me scroll down. For most Native Americans of old, meat was not only not the food of choice, its consumption was not revered, as in modern times when Americans eat turkey on Thanksgiving as if it were a religious duty. There was nothing ceremonial about meat. So mainly plants and tobacco that we used during ceremonies. So too bad Thanksgivings of today were not the way they were in the past, right? Okay, we'll continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, goveganradio.com. Greetings and welcome to the second hour of Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. We are live Sundays from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Pacific Time, syndicated by the Genesis Communications Network. You can also click listen live at goveganradio.com. A lot of people, I hope, will be doing that on the December 7th program, because that's when we'll be giving away a free green ticket to the World Vegan Summit and Expo. And wouldn't that be great for yourself? Or you can give it away as a great gift. And all you have to do is email goveganradio@gmail.com. And then in the subject area, put win. In the text area, put your name and phone number. And then listen live, goveganradio.com. on Sunday, the 7th, December 7th, between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Pacific time. And then if you hear your name, you have 10 minutes to call to win the green ticket. You have 10 minutes. If we don't hear from that person within 10 minutes, it's on to the next name, and we'll just keep doing it until we give away that free green ticket. So you can be at the World Vegan Summit and Expo, where one of the speakers is our next guest, who is Michael C. Dorff, currently the Robert S. Stevens Professor of Law at Cornell University. He's a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School, and the author of 4 books and numerous scholarly articles on law, many of which address the subject of law and social change. In 1991-92, he was a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. His blog is Dorff on Law, where the 3 principal authors are vegan. Let's see, by the powers of deduction, let's see, he being one of the 3 principal writers, he must be vegan too. So welcome, Professor Dorff. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me on. Please call me Mike.
Okay, Mike, glad to have you here. And so tell me how, you know, somebody with your very impressive academic background and credentials, Harvard, Supreme Court, still would decide to go vegan.
2 words, Gary Francione. So my wife, who was a guest on your show a while back, Sherry Kolb, was Gary's colleague for many years, and we were persuaded by Gary long before we actually made the change. We've been vegan for about 8 years now, but you know, for years before that, we were sort of very slowly, in retrospect, ridiculously slowly transitioning, because you know people change the way they are for all sorts of reasons. In some cases, it's a personal experience. In other cases, it's a some life-changing event. In some cases, it's just the force of reason, and that was what Gary was for us.
Mm. Was there anything that threw it over the top so everybody could hear?
In some sense, of intra-family competition. So Sherry tells a story about how in the summer of 1996, we spent some time in the Netherlands, and there was a walk we took to get each day from where we were staying to where I was teaching at the time. And we passed by a little farm. It was a family farm where they had some goats. And, you know, now, of course, I know that those goats didn't have anything like a good life. But at the time, I thought, oh, aren't they cute? And they came up to us each day, and they were very friendly. And so we decided, you know, we sort of started looking into things because we'd been hearing these messages from people around, but you sort of tune it out. So we then gave up eating mammals, and of course that was a senseless line to draw. So then we, you know, gave up birds, and we kept leapfrogging one another until one day, and the way I tell the story, I actually did this the day before Sherry did, I said, you know, I'm vegan now. And then the next day she was vegan, and then our kids were vegan, and sort of it's been a, you know, piece of cake since then.
Right, and the vegan cake is pretty good too, you know, living life happily ever after, so terrific, yeah. So, Mike, you recently wrote an article that will be in American Vegan Magazine, based on a talk that you gave in Princeton in March. It's Lessons from Other Justice Movements, A Lawyer's Perspective. So, well, can we get into that and see might learn?
Yeah. So I do a lot of my sort of professional work in what might be called sort of just technical law, the sort of thing that's boring to real people. But I also do a fair amount of work that sort of looks at the relation between law and the way the world actually changes. Because, you know, people, I find that when my students come to law school, they have this naive idea that if you make a law or if there's a judicial decision, the world actually changes and conforms to that. But that's it turns out that doesn't always work that way. And sometimes, of course, you don't even succeed in changing the law. So what that talk and the essay based on it are about is how, if you look at prior prior justice movements, and I take three, the civil rights movement, which I think of as a kind of extension of the slavery abolition movement, the women's rights movement, and the movement for rights for LGBT persons, that there are parallels with the animal rights movement. And there, of course, there are also differences, but the thing that I guess I emphasize two things. One is that it can take an incredibly long time to actually move people, even after you have truth and justice on your side, but that once things begin to move, they can snowball. So just think about the gay rights movement over the course of the last 50 some odd years. So I'm 50 years old, which I like to think of as not very old, and yet, you know, I remember as a teenager that people who were gay were completely stigmatized. And I have friends now who I knew as kids who now are gay, and you know, if I had known that as a kid, I'm sure I would have been a horrible person to them, because it just, you know, that's just the way people were. Even though, of course, there was no good reason to do it to be like that then. Just as there was no good reason to, you know, ever own people as slaves. Just as there was no good reason for men to subordinate women. But what makes things change is not that all of a sudden, one day, you know, people wake up and realize, oh my God, what we've been doing all along is evil. What happens is that there are movements, and people influence other people. You know, I think about my. I'm sort of rambling here, but I'll bring it back.
No. Please, no. Continue.
Right. In the introduction, you mentioned the three main bloggers on my blog are myself, Sherry, and a guy named Neil Buchanan, who's a law professor at George Washington University Law School. But another piece of that is that Neil was Sherry's and Gary's colleague at Rutgers Newark for a few years and has been my friend for many years. And I don't think it's an accident that the three of us, none of whom were vegan 10 years ago, sort of all brought each other along. So people changing their views, even towards justice, even though it's something that we think ought to be not so personal, is often a part of, you know, it's partly mediated by personal relationships and personal experiences. And so the question then is, so what is the role for the law in that, which is what I've been thinking about a lot. And I think the answer is it's not nothing, but it's in some sense less important than people often think. The law is in some sense a kind of side effect of people's hearts and minds. Right, so if you ask, well, why is it that we got formal legal equality based on race before we got it based on sex, before we got it based on sexual orientation, and someday, hopefully, species? I think the answer is not, well, that's because of, you know, the way in which the laws were written or the cases were decided. The laws were written and the cases were decided in that order because that's the order in which people woke up to the injustices. So, you know, the main lesson there, I think, is that you have to recognize the limits of the law, whether it's, you know, people who are bringing lawsuits on behalf of captive animals, right, who of course shouldn't be captive, but, you know, you shouldn't think that that in itself is going to bring about any kind of a change, or passing, you know, these sort of meaningless welfare measures, right? That's not going to bring about change either. It's possible that something like that could raise consciousness, and that's, you know, that one can always hope for that. But that the place, I think, for activists to be putting their energy at the stage we are now, where we've got a movement that's gaining ground but is still very much a minority position, the place for us to be putting our energy is on horizontal movements, reaching out to our fellow citizens through sort of direct action and persuasion, rather than trying to bring about change through the law, which is, you know, inevitably going to fail if we try to impose it at this point before people are ready for it. Now, I don't want to sound like somebody who says, oh, you know, you got to go slow. I think we got to go fast. But I'm saying you got to go fast through the right channels. So that's the sort of lesson, the sort of big picture lesson I draw from looking at circumstances in which, you know, people brought lawsuits or sought changes in the law, and then nothing really changed because they didn't have a strategy for bringing around sort of the rank and file, their fellow citizens.
But so in a sense, we're saying that justice will prevail. We just don't know when. We hope the sooner the better. And I don't know, be patient and don't give up.
Yeah, so it's not, I don't want to say be patient, right? That is, you know, I think that.
Yeah, it's hard to be
urgency.
Patient, by the way. Yeah, there is that sense, yeah, there is that sense of urgency. You're right. It's life and death, you know,
that's
constant.
Right. It's life and death for the particular animals who are being, you know, tortured and killed. And it's life and death for the, you know, the entire planet, right? Given the environmental degradation caused by animal agriculture. So, yeah, so I don't want to say be patient in the sense of, you know, take your time and relax. What I want to say is that is don't give up, right? Sometimes it looks like you're hitting your head against the wall, and you are for a long time, and then all of a sudden you notice that the wall has cracked.
We have to take a break. We're up against the break. We'll continue with Professor Michael Dorff of Cornell University on GoVegan Radio with Bob Linden. Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com and on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden on Facebook. And we invite you to join us at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. The website, worldvegansummit.com. You can register now. We're also giving away a free green ticket on the December 7th program, and I'm sure you can track down details somewhere in my social media. And today we're talking to Professor Michael Dorff of Cornell University, and also Professor Gary Francione, who does a weekly commentary on this program, joins us, both of whom will be speaking at the World Vegan Summit and Expo, and also Michael Dorff's wife, Sherry Kolb, who was a guest on this program not that long ago, talking about her book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger. So welcome, Professor Francione, to our discussion here.
Hi. Well, thank you, Bob. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Gary.
Yeah.
So I already credited you for making me a vegan earlier in the show.
Yes, there you go. So look at all the good you've done in the world there, Professor Francione, and we'll do more in March. So before the break, in talking to Mike here, we were talking about his article, Lessons from Other Justice Movements, A Lawyer's Perspective. And from what I'm gathering, some of what we learn is that, you know, that it's, you know, justice will prevail. And even though, you know, it seems like things are taking forever and we're banging our heads against the wall, you know, justice will prevail. So don't give up, you know. And, you know, in that sense, I can see why other people who don't have the patience, knowing that something's going to happen eventually, will want, you know, baby steps or legislation. But then Professor Dorff, Gary, said that legislation isn't the answer either, which is unusual. You might think a professor of law talking to law students would say, you know, like, make laws related to this. But apparently, you know, don't go tax meat and don't, you know, ban gestation crates. And so jump in and Mike, if you wanted to continue your thought, and Gary, jump
well,
in.
Yeah,
and
I mean, look, I'm not saying don't make laws. You know, I think that those are hard questions. My view is partly influenced by Gary on this, of course, which is that it's a question of where you want to devote your energy, where you're going to get biggest bang for the buck. And, you know, at some point, you know, if we're in a world where, you know, 60% of the population is vegan, sure, at that point I would say you could have laws in the same way that we have laws against murder. But, you know,
the problem with laws now is that, A, eventually they will be overturned because, you know, the political influence and the money are with, you know, those engaged in animal exploitation. So the laws either get overturned or ignored, really. You know?
Well, and the thing is, it's not just the people with the money. I mean, it's also ordinary people, right? So long as, you know, why don't we have a dollar a gallon gasoline tax, right? It's not just because the automakers oppose it. It's also because people want cheap gas, even though it's against everybody's collective long-term interest. It's the same thing with animal agriculture. You know, it's not just that McDonald's would oppose our, you know, legislating them out of existence. Their customers would too. So we got to appeal to those customers first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Gary, what do you think, that justice will prevail? So you know, it's hard to be patient, right? We have this sense of urgency. It's life and death by the billions. But we think, you know, we're creating the vegan world. It will happen because justice will prevail.
Well, look. I mean, I think that at this point in time, you know, pursuing laws is not only a waste of time, I think it's actually counterproductive, because we're not going to make any progress. The only thing that's going to happen is we're going to convince people that there's a compassionate way to exploit, and that we can make this, we can do this better, and that just perpetuates the continued consumption. So I really don't think at all that, and I realize I'm a law professor saying, that the law is not going to do anything for us right now. I agree that if at some point we have a large number of people who are committed to vegan...
Whoops. There's the music of life that says we have to take another break. So we will continue with Professor Gary Francione and Professor Michael Dorff, both of whom will be speaking at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. You can register now at worldvegansummit.com. Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com. On Twitter at GoVeganRadio, GoVeganRadio with Bob Linden on Facebook. And don't forget, you can register now for the World Vegan Summit and Expo at WorldVeganSummit.com. We're also giving away a free green ticket. And my guests today, Professor Michael Dorff and Professor Gary Francione, are both speakers at this event, the World Vegan Summit and Expo, where you'll meet the people from Greenlight Meals. Wherever you are in the USA, you have no excuse now to not go vegan, because you can have your meals delivered, delicious meals delivered right to your door, home or office, by Greenlight Meals. That's greenlitemeals.com. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, smoothies, desserts, foods the kids will love, and also nutritional and weight loss consultation available with Melissa Bright. So again, the website is greenlitemeals.com, greenlitemeals.com. And here we are. We're talking to two law professors who seem to be against utilizing legislation to advance the vegan movement. And, you know, I think the example of the foie gras ban in California is kind of a good example of that. Everybody celebrated and cheered and, you know, drank champagne until we found out that restaurants would decide to serve foie gras as a garnish. So if you buy a cracker for $20, you'd get foie gras on the side. One restaurant said, hey, we're not on state land, we're on federal property, we're going to sell it. And And then the attorney's office in San Francisco said, we're not going to enforce it in any restaurant. So, so much for legislation. Now what do we do, right? So, jump in, Michael, Gary.
I think that there are a lot of these measures, and Gary was pointing to one kind of flaw in them, right, which is it reassures people that everything's okay now so that they can have their happy meat. You're pointing to another, which is that, you know, just because you pass a law, even if you think it's a good law, and even if you think it's a principled law, it doesn't mean that people are going to enforce it if it's totally inconsistent with everything else that they're doing. Right. So again, right, there's a place for law. I'm not an anarchist. But the question is, you know, is, you know, the law can bring people's values along somewhat. It can't radically change them.
Mm-hmm. So then what are you telling your law students then to you know, how to engage in the vegan movement? Then they might want to run off and, you know, we need a law to, you know, to tax meat or something. So what would you instead suggest they do?
So here's a good one. In I have friends who live in Pasadena, who are fabulous vegan cooks. They would like to produce some items in their spare time for sale. Some vegan treats to sell at farmers markets and other places. They can't do it. Why? Because there's a law in California that makes it illegal to sell food unless you have a commercial kitchen. Apparently, the only kind of animals you're allowed to have in your kitchen are dead animals, right? Because they've got a cat and a dog, so they can't do it because it's their home. So, a place for vegan lawyers would be to, you know, get an exemption from that law or repeal that law. So there are places where you can make a difference, but it's mostly, I think, in supporting people who are engaged in vegan activism.
Mm-hmm. You know, that was the topic of Anna Charlton and I are teaching a seminar this semester, Animal Rights, Law, and Theory at Rutgers. And that was the topic of last week's discussion was, what can we do as lawyers? And the point that we made was basically that we can use our legal abilities to support people who are out there trying to change the world. But the idea that lawyers are going to change the world by changing the status of animals or by improving the welfare of animals, that's just silly. That's not going to happen. And that the best thing that we can do is to help the people who are trying to change things. So whether they're people like Michael's friends who would like to produce vegan food but have to deal with bureaucracy, or people who are doing other vegan advocacy, you know, engaged in other vegan advocacy efforts and are being stymied in some way, or people who are just doing good things for animals. I mean, one of the things that we've done a lot over the years is to try to help people who are doing trap, neuter, and return work, because a lot of municipalities tell people they can't feed cats. Now, the only way that we're going to get rid of these large feral cat populations is through trap, neuter, and return. It's not poisoning, in addition to being immoral, is ineffective. And so, you know, helping people who are trying to do things, to change things for animals and to shift the paradigm. You know, there was an interesting study that was done. I'm sure Michael's familiar with it. Mike, you know that study that was done by the people at Rensselaer about the 10% tipping point? Are you familiar with that? Yeah, and you know, and what these folks at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute came up with was this idea that if you have 10% of the population seriously embracing life, it doesn't mean that things change immediately, but what it does mean is that the conversation changes, and it means that the idea starts really getting treated and discussed in a serious way in society. And that's what we need to do. We need to get 10%. Not just of vegans, but people who are abolitionist vegans who are absolutely committed to veganism as the moral baseline for, you know, and who take this seriously as a moral proposition. If we could get to that 10%, and I believe we can. I believe we can get to that point. It won't mean that things will change overnight. What it will mean is that we'll change the conversation. And as more and more people become convinced that veganism is the moral baseline and that if you take animals seriously morally, the only rational response is to go vegan, what will happen is, you know, we'll see changes. And at some point in time, probably not in my lifetime, but we'll see at some point You know, the fact that laws will be useful, will be able to use the legal system in ways that will be better and more productive and less counterproductive for animals. Right now, I think it's these legislative campaigns. I mean, I remember when I opposed the foie gras thing in California, the hate mail I got about that. You know, oh, you're being negative. This will work. This is a marvelous idea. Well, sorry, it's a terrible idea. And as we've seen, it's a terrible idea.
Let me give one other sort of framing point. You know, in the social movements literature, there's a large body of work that says that sometimes, in some contexts, you can win by losing, right? You can have a lawsuit, you lose the lawsuit, but you raise people's consciousness. Or you have a legislative campaign, and it doesn't really do what you want, but you build connections. And I think that's a real phenomenon, and it sometimes works. You can win by losing. But usually, you lose by losing. And so, if you're sort of going, setting out to decide what to do, it seems to me you want to figure out how can you win by winning. And so that's why, you know, to me, the most logical use of our resources as lawyers or whatever our talents are, is to support people who are really doing what we want to do, which is to bring about veganism, rather than whatever the particular minuscule change potentially counterproductive is.
Mm. So, you know, California, we have in some areas banned plastic bags. In fact, I spoke to the council member who introduced that in San Francisco, and I said to him, well, if you could ban plastic bags, can't you ban something that's really harmful? Like, you know, that we can measure. Look at the hospitals in San Francisco. Look at water usage. Look at the environment. Look at all of that. And he didn't think it was such a crazy idea, you know. And to me, I'd like the campaign to ban meat, dairy, fish, and eggs. I don't know if we'd win, but I would think that would raise consciousness. Like, to, you know, I mean, am I crazy, or do I need to wait for another few percentage points to go vegan?
Well, I mean, that certainly would not contradict Gary's principle, right? That is to say, there you'd actually be campaigning for something which, if you got it, would make a real difference, assuming you could get it enforced. You know, again, right, until we've hit that tipping point, you're not going to get it, but you might be able to raise some consciousness, and you wouldn't have to give sort of fake answers to people who ask you, well, you know, you're trying to ban this thing but not that thing. How is this thing worse than that thing, right, when the answer is it isn't? Here you say, no, it's all bad, and that's why we want to ban it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you would think at Berkeley or, you know, in Berkeley or somewhere, some progressive area, taking a look at animal agriculture being the number one cause of climate change and disease and billions of animals. And, yeah, just all the way around, somebody somewhere would say, hey, what are we doing here? Let's ban this, you know. Or
I mean, the problem is that the whole happy exploitation movement has been incredibly successful. And, you know, I mean, we're now seeing the Values Matter advertisements, the Whole Foods campaign on television. And, you know, it brought to us courtesy of HSUS, PETA, Compassion Over Killing, Mercy for Animals, Vegan Outreach, and all these groups that have been supporting this whole happy exploitation nonsense. But it's worked. It reinforces, it tells people what they want to hear. You can continue, you don't have to change much, you know, you just have to shop at Whole Foods and pay a little bit more money. But basically, you don't have to change your life. You know, you can continue doing what you're doing, and you can still save the world. And it's nonsense. I mean, it's complete nonsense propaganda. But it's worked very, very well. It's worked very, very well. As a matter of fact, it's the biggest problem we have right now. Is the happy exploitation movement. It's not animal exploiters. It's the happy exploitation movement that is being promoted by all of these large animal charities. That's the problem. That's the biggest problem we face.
Mm. Just infused with many tens of millions of dollars of Sam Simon's money, right? Going to
Well, I mean, you know, but see, the thing of it is that the level of consciousness about the issue is low in that. That's why we need to get to the 10%. That's why we need to get to that 10% to change the conversation, because right now the conversation is only about treatment. And so anybody who comes into the issue is coming into it most likely from the treatment angle, and they're thinking about treatment issues. and they're thinking about how do we improve the treatment. That's because that's the discourse. That's what's been set by these large charities. And until that changes, you know, we're not gonna get anywhere. We're not gonna get anywhere that's gonna be useful. We're gonna continue to be mired in this discussion about treatment. That's the problem.
Okay, we need to take another break. We'll continue on Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, with Professor Michael Dorff of Cornell University, Professor Gary Francione, abolitionistapproach.com. Both speakers at the World Vegan Summit and Expo. You can register now at worldvegansummit.com. It's Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden at GoVeganRadio.com, on Twitter at Go Vegan Radio, and Facebook, Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden. We are talking today with Professor Michael Dorff of Cornell University, law professor, who will be speaking at the World Vegan Summit and Expo, as, of course, Professor Francione will be. And again, it comes down to, it seems, the damage to animal advocacy by so-called animal welfare. And I mentioned earlier that Sam Simon and Mercy for Animals teamed together so that we should all ask Chick-fil-A, quote, for less cruel killing methods. So that's what it's come down to. Our cause, you know, my campaign has to be, I should be calling Chick-fil-A for less cruel killing methods. That's a direct quote from Sam Simon and Mercy for Animals. And if you go to the Humane Society of the United States Facebook page, there's pasture turkey cooking tips and the admonition that Americans throw away more than a third of all edible turkey. So I guess it would be humane to eat more. Don't waste. Eat that third and you're humane enough for them. Right, Michael and Gary?
I pulled up an article on Inside Philanthropy, which I guess is some magazine about philanthropy, that talks about Sam Simon's giving. And, I'm glad Sam Simon, has all this money to give, and he's a vegan, and, I appreciate that. But, one of the most peculiar things about this article is it says that, unlike a lot of other philanthropists and foundations that are so staid and cautious, he's trying to be bold. And, I think it's just sad that it counts as being bold to tell people that, Chick-fil-A should, torture chickens a little bit less awfully. But I don't want to be a downer, right? So I'm going to give you a nice piece of happy advocacy. So at Cornell Law School, for no apparent reason, each year they have a fundraiser for public interest law that consists of a faculty pie-eating contest. If you've ever seen a pie-eating contest, it consists of the competitors. You have to eat the pie with just your face. You can't use your hands. So it's a ritual of humiliation. So a few years ago, they twisted my arm and I entered. I said, I'll enter, but only if I get a vegan pie. So they gave me a vegan pie, and I won. Then everybody started complaining. They said, oh, yeah, the vegan pie was probably denser. That's why Dorff won. So I said, okay, make all the pies vegan. And they did. And I won again. And then they said, well, yeah, sure, you're used to eating vegan pie. So this year, we had it again. And I made sure that I won by such a large margin that nobody could say that there was any excuse. It's just that, being vegan makes you better at everything, even gluttony. and so that was a kind of local activism, and it raises awareness when you began our segment, Bob, by asking me how is it that somebody who's well educated could be a vegan, and my question is how is somebody who's well educated could not be a vegan if you're actually you've actually paid any attention and the answer is it's easy because you get all these messages. I wasn't a vegan until I was in my early 40s, so I certainly don't blame other people for committing the same sins I did. But there are so many ways to get a positive message out there that don't involve compromise that it really is a shame that people feel the need to be so timid.
Right. And I think the same thing. There's so much information out there now. How could you not be? There's no excuse, you know. If you're on the internet, you know you should be vegan. So I don't know. It's just, it tastes good. I guess that's it. It tastes good.
I think we've got to move people in the direction of recognizing veganism isn't extreme. What's extreme is that we all claim we care about it. Many of us claim we love animals. Continue to exploit. That's what's extreme. That's what we really need to put up with, the idea that there's nothing extreme about nonviolence. There's nothing extreme about putting your moral where your mouth is and not consuming any animals anymore.
Whoops, are we losing? I'm not sure if we're losing you on the call, Gary. The sound quality is down.
I'm here.
There you are. Much better, right. So,
yeah, no, I was just... And I think we just need to move people in the direction of recognizing that veganism is not extreme. What's extreme is that we continue to exploit animals, and we don't recognize that, you know, that if animals matter morally at all, we cannot exploit them.
We can't, right. What's extreme is eating a decomposing dead bird as a celebration. So thanks, Professor Michael Dorff and Professor Gary Francione, for being with us today. We will see you at the World Vegan Summit and Expo in March in Marina Del Rey. Register. Come out there. Meet us all. Go to worldvegansummit.com. Thanks for being with us.